What's up, y'all? It's me, Dez, and welcome back to another episode of the Creative Power Hour with Marcus Whitney. We have another great episode for you guys, and on our show today, our guest is former Tennessee Titan Derrick Morgan. Derrick talks about his awesome story of challenging the status quo pretty much all his life, from his journey to playing football in college, to the pros, to receiving his MBA, to even his plant-based diet. Marcus and Derrick talk about it all on today's show. Check it out.
This is Marcus Whitney's Audio Universe.
Like, you gotta do the work. You gotta show up and just do the work.
Welcome to another episode of the Creative Power Hour. I'm your host, Marcus Whitney, and today, my guest, Derrick Morgan. What's up, brother?
What's up with you, bro?
I'm good, man. Thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me.
This is incredible. Man, when did we first meet? We first met at Oasis Center.
Oh, yeah, exactly.
At Oasis Center.
Exactly. For the entrepreneurship curriculum.
Yes.
Right. That was what, 2015?
Yeah, 2015.
Yeah.
2015.
Wow.
Thank you for being involved in that. Hey. That was incredible. Right. You know what I'm saying? We graduated probably 40 or 50, you know, incredible kids through that program who have gone on to do great things.
Yeah.
But it was great to meet you and you know, start to build a relationship and just, like, follow your path and your career. And it's been great to see how it's all unfolded, you know, over time. I've gotten to know you much more for your entrepreneurial prospects, you know what I'm saying, in your creative endeavors than even your athletic ones.
Right.
But let's talk about the whole thing, man. So we always start these shows with an origin story. I let people start wherever they want. But it's always good if, you know, we can start somewhat around childhood. And you're pretty young. Yeah. So you're,
I just turned 30.
Yeah, you're pretty young. So.
Man, 30 is old till you get to it, right?
Yeah, like, that's right.
Exactly. Oh, man, I'm not that old, am I?
No, man.
Okay, so let's start back. I guess we'll start back at birth. I was born in 1989 in Lancaster, PA. You know, it's like a kind of like in the middle of the state. And, you know, grew up primarily, it was me and my mother. You know, for the first couple of years, you know, we actually lived at my grandparents' home. My mom was trying to get on her feet. Okay. And, you know, it was one of those things where, you know, she was a single parent and trying to make it work, you know, trying to make ends meet. And, you know, she had her parents who were pretty supportive and who really ended up playing a huge role in my life. You know, my grandparents have been there from day one, and I spent a lot of time with them growing up. And I think a lot of my values and you know, kind of worldview came from them, you know, just being, you know, super, like, moralistic and, you know, just honest people. You know, they were just good people to the core.
Can I ask you a question about that?
Sure.
You know, I feel like there's definitely a thing for African Americans where if you're fortunate enough to have that three generational upbringing. I had a similar deal. Both my grandfathers were not alive when I was growing up, but my grandmothers were, and my mother's mother in particular was instrumental in raising me. Now, I grew up in Brooklyn, New York, but my family was from the South.
Okay.
Where were your grandparents originally from? Were you always in the PA area, or
so,
like?
Yeah. My upbringing is weird. It's like, it's unique. So I'm multiracial.
Uh-huh.
My mother's white, my dad's black. You know, his family's from Jamaica.
Okay.
And my mom's side, they're like more like Pennsylvania Dutch, like just like you know, in the middle, like, of the state, and
okay,
you know, like literally across the street, it was an Amish farm, and like,
wow.
I used to get babysat by Amish people and ride in the horse and buggy. And so,
wow.
You know, here I am, the only kid with some melanin around in like a 10-mile radius.
Yeah.
And, you know, my grandparents are like super conservative, like, you know, like, you know, just blue collar, you know, middle class type of environment. And, you know, they weren't in any way ashamed of me. Like, they completely, like, took me under their wing.
You're
a
kid.
I know, but that's, you got to understand, though, like, the dynamic of my mom having a mixed child in that area, like,
massive.
It was not the norm. Like,
massive.
You got to think about, people think Pennsylvania, it's like, you know, Northeast, you know, more like liberal,
right,
and progressive.
Right.
But when you get, like, from Philadelphia to Pittsburgh, it's like Alabama.
I get you, brother.
You see what I'm saying?
I totally understand that, yes.
It was an anomaly. But I think that my grandparents did a great job of, like, bringing me into the family and making me feel like, I didn't realize that I was the only, you know, multiracial kid around. Like, I didn't really think about that until I kind of got a little older and I looked back, like, in the pictures, like, dang, I'm the only black kid in here. You know what I mean? So that was interesting growing up. And I mentioned, like, the first couple of years we were at their house and, you know, very, very country and, you know, just kind of a different lifestyle. Then my mom kind of got on her feet and we moved to, I would say, like, Section 8, you know, type of housing, and the environment was completely different.
Still in Lancaster?
It was in a place called Columbia.
Okay.
And about, you know, about 15, 20 minutes away, but, like, my neighbors, like, everybody was black, right?
Wow.
And so it was, like, a huge contrast, and, you know, I grew up in that type of environment for, like, about 5 or 6 years. You know, my mom was working a lot. She worked about, you know, probably 50, 60 hours a week.
Wow.
Driving forklifts at QVC. And, you know, I was like a latchkey kid. You know, I spent a lot of time with, like, babysitters and, like, older kids and, you know, just trying to find my place. And, you know, through that, I would say I started to develop more of, like, a diverse upbringing and worldview. And from that experience, and then about 5 years into it, my mom got on her feet again and was able to buy us a home, small little home. But that was more so like in like a white area. And so here I am like flip flopping, you know what I mean? And so I got to this place.
Man, this is incredible.
And it was like, okay, I'm back in this environment and that was like my first time when I really started to experience racism. You know, I got called the N-word and got, you know, all these things and got
so
a lot of.
So that never happened in the Amish community, but now you go into a place where there's homes and it's a community and it's a white community. And now you're experiencing racism for the very first time.
Experiencing that. And my mom, like, even at my mom's job, like, they found out that, you know, who her kid was, and they were calling me like a monkey and stuff. Like, you gotta, you know, you got some N, you know, nigger, babe, all these things. So, like, she was experiencing it. I was experiencing it.
By the way, I have to tell people this all the time. You know what I'm saying? Like, people always try to act like like the South is so racist and the Northeast is not.
What? Nah. It's still live.
Yo, it's still live up in the Northeast.
It's still alive up there.
It's so live. I experienced so much racism growing up in New York.
Right.
Yeah, okay. Anyway, I just wanted to make the point, like, you're not alone. I feel you on that,
it's
man.
Definitely prevalent. I would say out down in the South is a little bit more overt.
Yeah, you know what I mean? Sure.
But like,
there's a history thing. There's a Confederate flag.
There's
thing.
The Mason-Dixon line. So you think you're like safe up here,
right,
but you're really not, kind of thing. And, you know, so that was a whole experience. And then, you know, I got to like age 12, and then my mom got married, and they were commuting to like Philadelphia for work. And so we relocated to a city called Coatesville. And Coatesville was a very unique place. It sits within Chester County, which I come to find out is like the richest county in Pennsylvania. Mm. But then you have Coatesville, which is like this distressed area, is like an old steel town. So it kind of came and went with the steel industry. And so like that still did the economy. And so we had this, you know, humble like little house, and it wasn't in the hood. It wasn't in the country. It was, you know, my neighbors were like in Section 8, and there was like a hood behind my house. And then in the front of my house, it was more like, you know, country. So it was like another diverse setting. But my school was like, I would say it was like 50-50 down the middle.
Hmm.
So like 50% of the students came from the city of Coatesville, which is like majority, you know, African-American and Latino.
Mm-hmm.
And then the rest came from like the surrounding areas, like more in like the country of part of that, like Chester County affluent area. And so it was a very diverse setting. And, you know, I tried to, again, find my place.
Now, how old are you at this point?
I'm 12.
You're like 12. Okay.
And so, you know, coming into an environment where I'm the new kid again and like trying to find my way. A lot of how I did that was through sports.
Hmm.
You know, I really started to like kind of make friends through football, basketball, baseball, all those things. And so I started to like kind of build my core group of friends. And, you know, we kind of stayed, you know, together really until this day. You know, about 3 or 4 of my friends who, when I came into the 7th grade, were still cool to this day. And we still do business together to this day.
It's amazing.
So that was one of the things I was like really, you know, just happy about, having like that circle of friends who you could trust and you understood what their motives were. Like, it wasn't like they didn't come into the picture after the fact of the NFL and all those things. And so having that loyal friend base has been very, you know, very good for me and my family. So, you know, ended up graduating from high school early, about a semester early.
Okay.
Enrolled at Georgia Tech in 2007.
One thing you haven't said at all through this entire time, man, Were you like good at school?
Oh yeah, I was.
I just get this feel like you're good at school.
it's my mom. Right, my mom was really influential in my academics because it was like, okay, you come home, you can't leave the house until the homework's done type of thing.
And yeah,
if you're not on honor roll, you don't play football. And I was I got to get good grades.
Right.
And, you know, I was, you know, naturally like just diligent in my studies and you know, could focus, you know, when I needed to. Like, I would get my work done and then I would turn into the class clown. Like, but I would have my work done.
Right.
And, like, I was looking at my report cards the other day. My mom brought like this whole portfolio of stuff from like sixth grade. And I'm like, A's and B's. But like in the comment section, it was like, Derek continues to struggle to keep his focus and not disrupt the classroom. It was like a continuous pattern of that type of behavior.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of it was, you know, maybe looking for attention, looking for validation.
Oh, man.
You know, my dad not being really in the picture. My dad was locked up for about 6 years.
Wow, okay.
So, like, he missed from, like, age 6 to, like, 13-ish. And so
those are big years.
Yeah, like 12, 13. So, yeah, big years because I got a 7-year-old
son. Those are big years.
You got kids. You know how
– those are big years. Those are big years.
You are and, like, how influential those years are.
Man.
So I think I was like acting out. I always had like this behavioral issue during school. And, you know, one of the things I forgot to mention was when I was growing up in like that Section 8 housing and all that, we got the school district got rezoned. Right. So we were like district, you know, zoned for like a regular school district, whatever. But it got rezoned and we got put into like the richest school district in the area. And they had to send one bus to our development, our neighborhood.
Mm.
And the bus was like filled with like all black and Spanish people. And like we get to the school and we're like the outcast there.
Wow.
So we go into this environment that we're not privy to. And so like me, this may say me and you are like joking on each other, right? Like that's normal.
Yeah, it's normal. It's normal.
But at that school it's bullying.
Right, right,
so
right.
We get labeled.
Right.
And we get put into this box and like I'm getting in trouble for things I never really got in trouble for. And like that was a whole nother dynamic. And then, you know, fast forward to, you know, where I'm at in Coatesville, it's like, oh, well, I'm used to this. I'm what I'm kind of used to. But it was like so much, you know, settings and environments were like shifting throughout my childhood. So it was a lot of like I said, trying to find my place and all of that. And so like going back to your point, yes, my mom was very influential in my academics, and I always had to make sure that was a priority. And so when I went to Georgia Tech, that was like, you know, more of an academic type school, had some success in the athletic side, but more so I was looking at A, the type of degree I would have, being in Atlanta, being at a good school, having a chance to play early. That was another thing for me. I didn't want to go to, you know, a huge school and
right.
have to wait and redshirt. Like,
yeah.
I was like, nah, I'm trying to get in, play. Hopefully get to the league or whatever it is, but I don't want to wait.
Georgia Tech really is right in the pocket with that, isn't it?
Exactly.
It is, man. It's
exactly.
ACC, right?
ACC.
So it's certainly good enough.
Exactly.
Right? It's good enough.
Right.
Great education.
Yep.
Great location right in the middle of the city.
Right.
That's smart.
Right.
Smart.
Yep. And yeah. So, a lot of this is God, man, just the way this whole thing has been designed. Like, I could say I made good decisions as much as I want, but a lot of it was just, you know, favor and by design,
yeah.
in my opinion. And so ended up at Georgia Tech, had a pretty successful college career. The one thing about Georgia Tech is that people probably don't realize is that it's an academic school first.
Yeah.
So, yeah, you might be a Division I athlete, football player, but you're not necessarily getting treated any differently, maybe even a little worse
right,
than the
right.
average student. So when you go to class, you got to really show up and, like, you know, apply yourself.
Yeah.
You can't just coast through. So I learned a lot about time management at Georgia Tech and how to really, you know, engage and apply myself and be resourceful because you're on a 20-hour, you know, work limit in terms of football. That's the limit that the NCAA sets out for Division I athletes.
Okay.
We far exceeded that. Like, that wasn't even a thought. Like, you know, we did 20 hours by Tuesday.
Right,
you know what I mean?
Right,
so,
right.
You know, having to balance a full, you know, class schedule was difficult. And so I had to really figure that out. And I had a job the whole time I worked through college because I'm so glad I see the NCAA, like, that law just got changed.
Right.
in order to let kids, you know, market themselves, get endorsements, because I had to take out a loan when I was in school on scholarship. Like, I didn't have money. Like, my gas tank was always on 0 miles to empty. You know what I'm saying? And so I had to take out a loan. I drove forklifts my freshman year. Like, I had real life jobs, you know what I'm saying? Working and going to school and being an athlete. So I learned how to, I grew up real quick. You know what I'm saying? And so, by the way, I'm an only child too. So I had to learn responsibility at, mm-hmm. at an early age. And so mm-hmm. I think, you know, naturally I'm like,
you were the man of the house.
Right? A large part of my upbringing, a long time. I was. So I had to I'm like an old soul. I had to like grow up faster than normal, but I think it's benefited me in the long run.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, had a really good career, learned about work ethic, time management through my time there. And got to a place where I was in a position to be drafted in the first round by the Titans in 2010. You know, came here, and it was like coming to Atlanta was a culture shock, right? Like, that was a big culture shock to me. I'm like, what is the South? You know what I mean?
Right.
So I just
wasn't the flood in 2010?
The flood was in 2010.
Yeah.
I caught a flight out right when it was happening.
Wow.
And so when I got to Nashville, I was like, what is this? You know, like, what are we doing here? Like, it feels like we're 1995. Like, it felt like we was like 10, 15 years behind.
Yeah.
And that was another adjustment, because I remember going out. When I first got here, I went out with a couple of the vets, you know, to the club, and they were like, I'm looking around, I'm just like, man, this is kind of weak. You know, I went to school in Atlanta, right. So we were like in the mix,
absolutely.
You know,
and absolutely. So,
you know, we're partying with like Atlanta Falcons and like the Hawks and like big time names. And so like that was my college experience. It wasn't a small time college town.
Right.
And so when I got here, we went out and I was like, man, this is weak. The dude looked at me like, hey, this is as good as it's going to get. I was like, what? So I'm just like, dude, like I'm 21 years old. I'm trying to like live. And my priorities were a little different back then. And so I like literally every off day, I used to get on 24 and shoot to Atlanta.
Yeah.
You know, for the day and a half.
It's easy.
Yeah. You know what I mean? So I felt like I was missing something. I felt like I was missing out on something, because I had this in my mind, I had this, you know, this image or goal of like what I thought the NFL was.
Sure.
Right? I thought it was like this certain lifestyle that you live. You go out, you party, you buy things, you get the cars, you get the money, you get the women, all these things. And I was painting this picture from what I was seeing when I was in Atlanta and mm-hmm. like hanging out with those types of guys, and not understanding that was just the tip of the iceberg, like not understanding like the foundation that needed to be laid and like all the work that needed to be put in to get to a certain point.
Just a question about Georgia Tech. You were talking about that culture of it being an academic school first, and
yeah.
You know, clearly your coaches and the staff knew you had the potential. I mean, you're not the only person to ever go from Georgia Tech to the NFL, right? And so for those players who do have a shot at going to the NFL, what does that process look like from the interactions you have with the coaches? Do they spend any time like preparing you mentally, emotionally, providing wisdom and mentorship, or are you kind of on your own in that?
I mean,
I'm not asking you to throw anybody under the bus. I'm legitimately curious of you, because you're so young and impressionable, and this shift you're about to make, right? From like, look, you don't know gas in your car. You're working all the time. You've actually developed lots of great habits and perspectives, but you are about to shift into very different world, very very different world, very quickly.
You're severely underprepared.
Yeah,
severely.
Yeah,
and I think that I'm saying that from where I sat at Georgia Tech.
Right.
I'm probably a little bit more prepared than the norm.
Right.
But I felt severely underprepared. Like, I didn't know how to write a check when I got to the league.
Wow,
man. You see what I'm saying? So, like, I didn't understand all these different nuances of the league and what that meant and coming in the money and not having the financial literacy to really sustain that.
Yeah.
So you go into a point where – yeah, you're in college, you get told what to do, when to do, how to do it, and you're kind of in this bubble. And then when you get to the league, you're like, all right, you're a grown man now. You got to manage your own time. You got to be a professional. Nobody's telling you, hey, when you come home, you got to get a massage, you got to get an adjustment. Like, you got to take care of your body, be a professional. you almost got to learn those things, right? And so for me, you know, there is no, you know, cookie cutter program that says, okay, you're transitioning from the college world to the pro world. These are the tools and we're going to equip. Nah, none of that. You just kind of get in and you kind of like, oh, this is the league. And you kind of like got to feel your way through it. And it, a lot of it depends on who you have around you.
Yeah.
I see what I'm saying?
I mean, it feels like it's up to chance at this point, right? I mean, who's around you and who you end up navigating to.
It is.
Feels like a lot of how you're going to end up.
Because the vultures come out.
Right.
Oh. It's like,
oh my God.
Oh, a 21-year-old black dude, he don't really come from much and he coming into money. Oh, that's an opportunity right
there.
So
that's
people
right.
look at you like you're an opportunity, you're a come up. And so you start to like get all this baggage with you. Like people just kind of like holding on for the ride. Like, you know, wait, you know, what value are you bringing? You're
right.
just trying to eat off of me.
Right.
And so when you're a kid, you don't really realize that. You think people are there for you. And I luckily found out early on that that wasn't the case. That was a lot of fake love around my life. And I tore my ACL my fourth game of my rookie year. And that was a season ender. ACL to an athlete is like the three letters of death. You don't ever want to hear them.
Yeah.
And so when you do hear that, it's like, oh my gosh, is like my career over? How am I going to come back from this? I'm a first round pick. I got all these expectations on me. How does this affect me? And I remember one of my boys from my hometown, he was planning on coming down to the Eagles game. And I had just tore my ACL the week before. And he hit me up like, hey, man, I'm trying to come down to the Eagles game. Can I get some tickets? And I texted him back like, yo, I'm not playing. I just tore my ACL. He texted me back and said, oh, okay, that's crazy, man. Hey, but can I still get those tickets? And I was like, damn, like that just was like a paradigm shift for me because it put everything into perspective like, oh, dang, you're fake, you're fake, you're fake, you're fake. And I really just started to identify and look around at my team like, oh, these people are just here. They're here for what they can get
out of
this.
What they can get.
And they don't really care about me, the person.
Yeah.
And so from that experience of, like, I would say it was my rock bottom because after I tore my ACL, like, it really started to shake things up in my life of, you know, who was I? You know, who was Derek Morgan? And I had put everything into my athletic career and built that up and evolved as a person, as a football player, not a person, right? So I was deficient in all these other areas, and my identity was in football. And so when that veil kind of got lifted, and I was sitting in my living room with a cast on my leg and pain pills to my left, and I was just like, okay, what's going on? What am I doing?
Right.
I started to sink into depression and started to like really ask tough questions about who I was as a man. And I really came out of that process like having a completely different worldview and looking at myself like, all right, if that was your last game, what now? And that was hard. You know, that was hard to go through. And it was like, it woke me up. It woke me
up. But you asked that question. I mean, I think there have to be a large number of athletes. You know, I mean, you talked about those three letters being things that you don't want to hear, but the reality is we hear them a lot. You know what I'm saying? Yeah. A lot of athletes tear their ACL. You know what I'm saying? It's like the amount of force and the shifting that you guys are doing. And
right.
ACLs tear. Yeah. That happens. And I just wonder how many athletes actually looked into the darkness and asked that hard question as opposed to just said, I'm not worried about it. I'm coming back. You know what I'm saying? Like didn't actually lean into the unknown around that, you know? So anyway, I just think that's
because for a lot of guys to get to the NFL, you know, it's been smooth sailing.
Yeah.
You really haven't got hit with adversity. So you haven't had you weren't forced to like ask those challenging, insightful questions. Right.
And like, this is adversity in public.
Yes.
And I'm not talking about social media. I'm talking about CBS.
Yeah. Very public.
NBC, Fox, ESPN. I'm talking like SportsCenter.
Yeah.
I'm talking like this is different.
Everything.
This is different.
You can Google it now and it's going to come five, six articles coming up. So, you know, and then you start hearing those words like bust. Like, is this guy a bust and is he going to pan out? And in my mind, I'm like internalizing all this. And so I'm just like, you know, I can't be me. It can't be me. And so, you know, I picked myself up out that hole from a lot of prayer and just like, you know, really trying to like look inside myself and ask, understand who I was and derive my value outside of the game. Right. Like that's what everything points to, is like you're valuable because of your performance and what you do on the field. And I wasn't on the field for 9 months. Mm-hmm. It was just like, what am I doing? And I think, you know, all the things that I'm doing now, you know, off the field, like in business, investing, whatever it is, stemmed from that moment of waking up and realizing that football wasn't forever and taking an intentional path to better myself, right? It wasn't an overnight thing. It was like, okay, I'm 21. I can't play in this. Like, what am I going to do? Like, I can't sit here and play Call of Duty all day, even though I did a lot. You know what I mean? It was like that, you know, I had my son when I was 22, so I was quite young. And so I had to, like, grow up and, you know, in that respect. And so all these things started to come together in my life where I really had to, like, stop living so selfishly and really start to think big picture and long term. And, you know, now that I have a son, like, how does my decisions affect him? And so all these things forced me to, like, really mature early on in my career. And from that, I started to learn how to take care of my body, like how to become a professional. And, you know, I'm my own business. I'm the CEO of me. And I can't just go to the facility and do the bare minimum. I got to, like, as soon as I clock out, I got to come home and I got to, you know, ice my knee, or I got to take an Epsom salt bath, or I got to get a massage or get acupuncture, fly to Minnesota, get treatment, all these things. It was a litany of things that I had to, like, stay on top of, because in the back of my mind, I was like, I can't be that bust. I can't be a bust. I can't let down the expectations in my team and everybody else. And not to say that I was the most healthy ambition or motivation, but it was like something that I thought about a lot. And I started to develop a routine and just a way of going about my life and evolving myself more than just a football player.
Mm-hmm. You know, that's amazing. All right, man. There's a lot of places we could go from here.
Yeah.
Where do you want to go? Where do you want to go from here? Do you want to talk about going and getting your master's in business?
We could talk about that.
We don't need to talk about it a lot, but I mean, to me, it was an impressive thing because you were doing it. And you were still playing
right
while you were doing it. And you were also starting to scratch your entrepreneurial itch and starting to, you know, look at things. So mm-hmm. so I just found that to be really impressive.
Yeah,
so talk to me about that. Talk to me about the decision to go get your master's in business
right.
And what it was like doing that while you're also playing an NFL schedule.
It was hard. It was very hard. I thought about quitting a couple of times. I start back to the impetus of that, like how that started was – my finances. Okay. So I came in and I was some, you know, I looked at my account, and then sometimes it would be a couple of weeks before I looked at it again. And then, you know, about year two, year three, I'm like 23 at this point, you know, my advisor at the time, started to introduce
there's a whole story there.
that's another, we need another podcast for that. So my advisor at the time started to kind of introduce these alternative investments, right? Mm-hmm. Like these cash flowing investments that, you know, could offset my expenses. And I was like, okay, I need that. I like multiple streams of income.
Sure.
And so
sounds great.
Sounds amazing. who wouldn't want it? So we started, you know, diversifying into these investments, a couple hundred thousand here, a couple hundred thousand there. And I'm getting these coupons every month, right? You know, one company is like investing into like, I think like, what are those called? Walgreens and CVS's. Like it's some, I don't remember, but it was something to do with that. I'm like, okay, that seems pretty safe. And then another one was a government contracting company that did like fire alarms for the military. I'm like, okay, that seems boring enough. I mean, let's you know.
These things all sound good, by the way.
Right, exactly. So they hook you in
because
there's nothing like too exotic.
Yeah.
It's just like boring printing money type of things.
Yeah, I'm like, all right, CVS, cool. Walgreens, and government contractors all sound
right,
pretty
like,
boring.
Exactly. I'm mm-hmm. like, all right, cool. That's we'll look into that. And so I actually flew. I remember flying out to D.C. and, you know, I met with the CEOs and sat in his office and shook his hand and was like, he's like, yeah, we have all these government contracts, you know, around the world. And, you know, this is our pipeline, all these things. And so for about 18 months, I'm getting these coupons every month. And I'm like, okay, this is good. Like, and I tell
him, what do you mean when you say coupon?
Dividends.
Okay.
So like I'm getting,
You know, you're getting dividends.
Okay. Yeah.
Okay.
So every month I'm getting these dividends, coupons, whatever you want to call it.
Yeah.
And I'm like, all right, cool. This is working. So I hit my friend like, hey man, look, you know, hey,
I'm getting dividends.
You should look into this. Getting dividends. So look into this. And, you know, he ends up coming in. He invests his money in. Right. And so I'm looking at their practice. They got about 80 athletes, right?
Mm.
Big name guys. If I tell you the names, you'll know exactly who they are. And they're putting, like, millions into these investments. I only put a couple hundred. You know what I mean? They're putting mills in. And so everything is going good. And then I remember one time, I think 2013, the government shutdown hit, right? And so I don't know if it was related or not related, but them coupons, dividends, whatever you want to call it, started drying up. And I'm like, I'm checking my account. Like, all right, I ain't get my payment this month. So I call my friend. Hey, yo, did you get your payment? He like, nah, I ain't get mine neither. I'm like, oh shit, we gotta call a buddy. Hey, what's up, man? What's up with these payments? Everything's good, Derek. Don't worry about it. A couple months, the government shut down, slowing everything up. It'll be back online. I'm like, all right. It makes enough sense. 2 or 3 months go by, no more pain. I'm like, all right, what's really going on? Oh man, look, the guy, he was doing some shady stuff. And long story short, fast forward about 6 months later, all of our money is gone. gone. Like, what happened? Gone. And I'm just like, what do you mean gone? Oh, we're gonna file a lawsuit with the SEC.
Oh my gosh.
All these things. And so from that, it started to be revealed that our advisor was hand in hand with those guys.
Of course.
So, fast forward, the whole firm blows up. They lose all their clients. They can't practice anymore in the financial industry. We're out a couple $100,000. Some guys are out like up to six million. So it's just like, it's messy. It's like the traditional athlete and money story that you hear. And it's like, dang, like I didn't want to be that. But luckily, the investment rule I always use is, if I can't afford to lose it, then I don't need to invest in it.
Uh-huh. Yeah,
so
right.
So I was able, you know, it wasn't completely detrimental to me. It hurt, and it was a learning experience, but I was able to come back from it. And so from that process, I'm like, you know what, never again. I'm going to understand what my finances are doing. I'm not going to take a passive role. I'm going to get involved in this thing. I'm going to learn it, because I used to sit in meetings and just shake my head like,
you didn't even know what they were saying, really,
at all.
Right.
Speaking a different language,
right.
I'm just like, yeah,
right.
Okay, you understand that? Yeah, and that was pride,
right?
Yeah, it was pride. It's like, I don't want to look dumb. I don't want to look like the traditional athlete with money. I don't want to fit that stereotype. And so I would just sit there and just shake my head. And at one point, I don't know what happened, but I just woke up like, man, this is dumb. Why am I acting like I know what the hell going on? I don't. I'm going to start asking questions. This is my money. So I'm going to take a more intentional, active role. And, you know, we'd be in meetings and I was like, oh, wait, run that back. Explain it to me like I'm six.
Right.
I don't understand that.
Yeah.
I've been playing football all my life. I'm an expert in this. I'm not an expert in this.
Yeah.
So I started to really learn and dive into my finances and really that evolved.
And by the way, all of a sudden now you're asking the questions that every wealthy person in the world asks.
Exactly.
Explain it to me like I'm six.
Exactly.
Right?
Exactly.
Because the minute they start talking at like a, you know, graduate degree level, don't make sense.
Nope. I don't get that. It's my money.
That's
at the
right.
End of the day. So I really took an active role in educating myself on my finances, and that led into, you know, investments and, you know, real estate. And then, you know, the next progression was getting my MBA. It was like, let me take my knowledge to the next level.
Got it.
And, you know, I'm in this position of being a professional athlete. We have certain access to people and things that most people don't have access
to. That's right. Status. Big status.
What it is.
Lots of value in the status, no question.
And the saddest thing that I was finding out is that most of us don't leverage that until it's over.
Right. And it does go away.
It goes
away. It's not forever.
It goes away.
Well, you can leverage it to the next thing, right?
Yes.
You can keep it going if you're smart, if you know how to do it.
Exactly.
You can do what Magic Johnson did or,
facts,
right?
Facts.
Shaq's bigger now than when he played,
for
right?
Sure.
So you can do it, but you got to do it.
You got to do it.
You got to do it.
You got to do it. You know, can we trademark that? You
yeah, do it. Absolutely. I mean, Dez, you got it?
You got to do it. Nikes just do it, but you got to do it. it's like I'm in the NBA program, and there are some retired guys in the program. And I'm talking about, like, perennial Pro Bowlers, like, you know, some Hall of Famers. Yeah. And they're like, yo, Derek. Like, I'm asking, like, I'm picking their brain. Like, hey, I seen your thing. Don't ever ask somebody to pick their brain. But I asked them that question. And I said, let me pick your brain. And I was like, hey, you know, what's some advice that you would offer somebody like myself who's still in the league, being that you're on this side? Hey, the number one thing they said was, do it now. Do everything now.
Yeah.
Don't just wait until you're done playing and take advantage of your off seasons. Don't party and trick off money and waste time. Do stuff now. And I'm looking at them like, dang, you played 15 years and made 6-7 Pro Bowls. Like, you got it all. But it's like, look, it ain't the same on this side. And I'm like, all right, let me take that to heart. And that really resonated with me. And so, you know, going through the NBA program, you know, my whole thing was, let me find out, A, what I like, what I don't like, and B, let me take my level of education to another level. And let me see, look at my network and say, okay, who can I access? Who can I, like, rub elbows with and start to develop and enhance my reach and my access and my network? And so from that program, I started to really understand how to network and how to be strategic and who you align yourself with. And, you know, when I first came to the league, I hated, and I still kind of do, like, hate social settings. I'm more introverted, yeah. But, like, I had to get out my shell and really, like, hey, you know, what do? Like, shake hands and take business cards and, you know, that type of thing, because people wanted to be around you and they wanted to be around professional athletes and, you know, you can leverage that. And so, you know, from that, and I think actually the first time we met was at South by Southwest.
Was it?
Not the first time. Like, one of the second,
when we
early
really,
times.
When we really, like, talked.
Talked.
When we really talked.
Was South by. Yeah. And, you know, the reason why I was there was, me and my partner at the time, we had, you know, been looking at different entrepreneurial things that we could be involved in and been looking at, like, education and access to technology. I hope you guys have an edit. access to STEM education,
yeah,
and, like, technology careers, because there's, like, a huge skills gap.
Massive.
On what jobs are available as opposed to who's qualified for these jobs.
I'm sure when you talk to Josh Mundy, y'all talked about that. The Pivot Tech stuff, did he not talk to you about this?
Wait, you talking about the school he's doing?
Yeah.
He talked about it briefly. It was, like, in passing, but okay. I wanted to, like, follow up with that.
Okay, let's just put a pin in that. We got to make sure we get that.
Right.
Okay, let's keep going. Let's keep going.
And so, you know, I always looked at my platform like, all right, I'm here. I got a certain level of influence. How can I leverage that for the good of others?
Yeah.
Okay, we're doing football camps. We're doing back-to-school drives and Thanksgiving handouts. Like, that's cool.
Yeah.
But is that really making a dent?
Right.
No.
No.
You got all these systemic cycles that have been intentionally put in place, and we're in this certain level of influence as almost like the pinnacles of our communities, and we're misusing our influence. We have outdated playbooks. We're still doing the same things, and you're not seeing any change. And so I'm like, okay, what's something tangible? This is why we met at the Entrepreneurs Oasis Center.
That's right.
About entrepreneurship.
That's right.
Like, we're ingrained, I mean, my generation, more so your generation, that we have to go to college to be successful.
Yeah, that's right.
And that's not the case anymore. And so I'm a big advocate of, hey, if you can't go to school and get a career and a job, great, but that's not the only avenue to success. You could be an entrepreneur. You could be a business owner, start your own thing.
That's right.
Be your own boss. And so I started looking at different ways and pathways to success outside of, or not outside of, but in addition to higher education. And so, you know, looking at different ways to, like, get access to technology and training for underserved youth. And the reason why we were at South By was we took 100 kids from HBCUs primarily, mm-hmm. To South by Southwest to get them in the room with decision makers from Twitter and Google and MailChimp and Microsoft. And a lot of these kids got careers from that opportunity. And that's like, okay, that's something tangible that you could see.
Yes.
And that's a pathway out of poverty and to build wealth, because at that time I was looking at the racial wealth gap and, like, coming, like, wait, the average white household is worth, like, you know, 10 times
it's 10x.
More.
It's 10x.
It's 10x,
it's
right?
It's 10x.
10 times more than the average black household. I'm like, whoa, like we're set up to fail.
Right.
And what are ways to build wealth for our community? And technology was one of those ways.
Right.
And so that was why I was there. And you know, a couple other things spun off of that. And, you know, we did a 2 years ago in Nashville, we did a technology camp, sports technology camp.
Nice.
Where the first half of the day was traditional football camp. Yep. And then the second half was based around technology, flying drones, data and analytics, programming, all those different things. And so it was like, I've always been like, not always, but over the past few years, like, how can I be more intentional with my influence? And from that, you know, I'll stop actually right there. I don't know if you got any questions.
No. Look, this is great, man, because I think this is a good segue into the present. I do want to get into food. But the reason why, I mean, look, the reason why I'm so impressed with you and why I wanted to have you on the show is not because you're an NFL player. I mean, it's because of everything else you've done while managing to keep up a career as an NFL player. You know what I'm saying? The three main interactions we've had now, one was at Oasis Center to co-create the Oasis Venture Program. Yep. The second one was at South by Southwest, which was so impressive to me because I don't know if you know that much about my story, but like South by Southwest was the pivotal moment in my life. Mm. Like in terms of like really helping me, because I went in 2007 when Twitter launched when Gary Vee went for the first year. So I was there when it was like, you know how big it was when you went, there was like 2,000 people when I went. It was small when I went. You know what I'm saying? Wow. So like everybody who's big right now, like, I got a picture of me with Matt Mullenweg, the guy who started WordPress.
Oh, wow.
So like everybody who's like big now was all just hanging out at South by back in 2007. Gotcha. So the fact that you saw that and you used your status and your resources to bring all those kids there was massive impressive. And then just by chance, we met up at Nexus.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? And I don't know if you saw my name on a list or something, but like you texted me, you was like, yo man, I'm at this I'm at this thing too. Cause I took a complete flyer. I was there by myself. I think, as you know, you were there with your lovely wife, but I was there by myself, man. I was like
solo.
Yeah. Yeah. I was like, you know, I need a new experience, you know, and it was kind of out of the box, you know what I'm saying? Yep. And then boom, I see you there and you're like on the agenda. You've got, you know, an actual thing that you're doing there. So talk a little bit about that. I wrote a whole thing about my Nexus experience, by the way. I'm gonna send you a link to it.
Dope.
It was the first event that I had gone to that had that gender balance. Mm. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Where like there were as many women that really
That's
a little
true.
Bit more women
yeah.
than men.
That's true.
Where it's about like wealth and entrepreneurship and creativity. Like all the events I go to, you go to a lot of them too now. Mm-hmm. They're all like male dominated, right? Mm-hmm. And I was so struck by it, man. That Saturday morning, I wrote I have a weekly newsletter called The Grind, and I wrote a newsletter called The Great Imbalance about how good the energy at the event felt.
Yeah.
And I think it was largely because it was led by women and like, and the balance was there. You know what I'm saying? Cause like the women were like very empowered, very safe, very, you know what I'm saying? Like speaking their mind on stage, incredible. And like, you just don't, there's not enough. It's not enough of that. Anyway, so you were at this event with your wife and I didn't get to be a part of your session cause I went to a different dinner, but talk about your session.
So first, I spotted you. We were in the UN, like main.
Is that how you saw me?
I'm scanning the crowd. I'm like, there's a black guy with dreads. Okay, I think I know him. Let me text him and see if he looks down at his phone. Oh, that's him. Hey, what's up? And so yeah, I'm like, dude, like that was crazy coincidence. Excuse me. The reason me and my wife were there, we were on like a food sustainability panel, and like it was me, her, and this guy. I think he had like a vegan dog food. There was another guy who was like really big in like to marine biology and saving the coral reef and all these things. And so that's kind of like that hasn't always been our lane, but it's kind of like getting into that lane because climate change and the environment is becoming such of a sense of urgency around it.
Oh, man.
Like, we're kind of naturally getting into that and really educating ourselves like, oh, shoot, like this is real.
This
you know
is
what
real.
I mean? Like there's timelines on this thing. Like, and if we don't change, it's going to be bad.
It's going to be bad.
And so like we're like kind of taking up, you know, this approach like, hey, like we got to be more of an advocate for this because it started back, you know, in 2017 where I was just looking for ways to recover faster.
Yeah.
That's all it was.
Right.
It was like, hey, you know, I'm asking these questions with my nutritionist, and she's sending me all these articles because she was plant-based, and she was like, hey, have you looked into this diet? I'm like, hell no, I can't be no plant-based athlete. Like, that ain't even happening. Like, I need protein.
Right.
And, you know, I'm going to shrivel up, and I'm going to lose my job. And I'm just like, hey, nah, I got bills to pay. Like, it's the reason we in this house. Like, I got to keep the lights on. And so it was more so a fear on my end, and I always try to keep an open mind. And I started looking into this, and I'm like, okay, I like to read research. I like to think critically about issues. Mm-hmm. I don't like to adopt people's opinions. I want to look at it
for yourself
and form my own opinion about it. And I'm looking at this research. I'm like, okay, I'm looking at this article and this article. I'm like, okay, this makes sense according to this data. You want to stop?
No, we keep going.
Okay, I love it.
Yeah.
Keep push through.
Yeah.
So I'm looking at this data, and I'm like, all right, this looks compelling. I'm going to try it out. At the end of the day, the worst is going to happen is I'm going to lose some weight, and I needed to lose some weight at the time because weigh-ins were coming. I was, you know, in the off-season, but when you come back and you report, you got a weigh-in that you got to, you know, adhere by, and I was about 5 to 6 pounds overweight, and in the NFL, it's like $700 a pound. And so I'm like, I'm going to do this, see what happens. And so I started to, like, gradually cut out the red meat. Okay. I was like a steak a week, hamburger a week type of guy. Like,
amen.
Yeah, I can't say amen to that no more. But
yeah, no. I'm plant based too now for like 45 days because of Nexus, man.
Oh, man,
because of Nexus,
real?
Yeah.
I didn't know that,
dog. That event, like, because it was the only topic they really drilled home because it was global. I mean, and that was the thing that just kept hitting. It was like climate change, and then I became friends with Adam, plant based addict on Instagram.
Yep.
So I met him at the event with you at the bar, and then we hooked up later, and I was just like, yeah, I need to do this. So I'm 45 days in.
Man,
impressive,
bro.
Yeah.
Congrats on that.
Anyway.
Congrats. That's all I'll say. My wife would be proud of you.
Yeah.
By the way, we got to get her on here.
We do have to get your wife on here. Yes.
So, I tried it. I just started cutting out red meat, cut out poultry. I'm going to tell you this. The biggest difference I noticed was when I cut out dairy.
Yeah,
dairy,
man.
Was like, dairy is not really for us. Right. Like, it's not really for us. And like, you got to think about it. Like, why are we drinking another animal's milk? At the end of the day, like, I'm grown. Like, we drink milk to mature, and it's filled with, like, you know, like growth hormone and proteins and amino acids. Like, it's full of that because you need that to kind of like jumpstart your system and grow and evolve. But like, why am I drinking a cow's milk or a goat's milk? That's not really for me, right? That's for their young. And so I'm like, okay, that makes sense conceptually. And I feel the difference in my body. I don't have as much mucus and inflammation in my body. And I got my blood tested about 6 months on the diet because we're all aware of placebo. It was like,
yeah.
I feel good. I got more energy. But let me like really lift up the
hood
and see what's going on. And bro, like when I tell you all of my levels were A1, like just perfect. You know, I was like, oh, like I had high blood pressure. I had high inflammation levels. My cholesterol was kind of high. And so like when I took the test, everything was like back at a really great level. And I was like, oh, this is working. And it coincides with how I feel.
Mm-hmm.
So from that point, huge believer in it.
Yeah.
And my wife's a Le Cordon Bleu trained chef. Not plant-based,
right?
But just chef. She has 15 years of experience, and you know she does it up. Her Instagram is Chef Charity Morgan. Check her page out because when you look at her food, it's like, oh, there's no way that's vegan. But like literally, I got a Caesar salad sitting in the car that's probably spoiling right now because it's hot. But like she has a real talent, bro. And so she got on board and started cooking plant-based, and it was game over. I was like, oh, I could do this for the long run,
right?
And I started bringing in my food to the facility at the Titan facility. And, you know, guys knew that my wife could cook because we had cookouts and just gatherings. They're like, oh, Charity can throw down.
Right.
And so I'm in the facility with my little, you know, my food. And guys are looking like, hey, yo, what you got? And I'm like, oh, it's a little, you know, salad or a bowl or burger. And like, oh, did Charity cook that? And I was like, yeah. She's like, oh, let me get a piece. You know what I mean? Because they knew she could cook. And so I'm like, you know that's vegan, right? They're like, nah, this ain't vegan. I'm like, it's vegan. And so that was around the time What the Health came out. You remember that?
Yeah, yes.
And so What the Health was like real prevalent then. So people was in the facility like, I'm going vegan. Like people in there just eating bread. I'm like, yo, you're going to die. Like you're going through training camp. Like you're going to kill yourself. Like, so, you know, guys were like, looking at my food like, hey, can I get a meal? And I'm like, yo, this ain't no meal plan service. So anyway, I called her. I was like, hey, guys are like asking to get on like the meal plan. She's like, there is no meal plan. I'm like, well, they're willing to pay for it. She's like, oh, okay. So she like, it literally started with like three guys, four guys, five guys. And then by the end of the season, she was cooking for like 17 guys.
Wow.
Full plant-based.
Wow.
You know, two meals a day.
Wow.
And you know, we actually had our best season that year. We went to the playoffs. Wow. And like won a playoff game. Hadn't done that in 15 years. And so it was a really cool story, man, and a cool journey. And like that kind of brought us to the point of like, you know, we did a ambassador deal with Beyond Meat. We were in this Game Changers documentary.
So you're in that?
We're in that.
I can't wait. Did it come
out
today?
Come out today.
October 1st. I was about to say, because I'm waiting for the
Right. It come out today.
That's amazing. So, I know what I'm watching tonight. That's what's up.
We're EPs on that, so thank you.
Yeah, of course.
You know, they really chronicled that story. And from that, you know, we've been kind of like just being more influential in the plant-based, you know, community. And that's how we ended up at Nexus talking about food sustainability and like what are the plans going forward type of thing. And so it's a huge movement. My wife has done a very amazing job at like kind of positioning us and having us be a part of the conversation.
You know, unfortunately, all this stuff is really kind of coming to a head. Here it is, you know, October 1st, 99 degrees outside in Nashville right now, right? And, you know, we just had, you know, Greta kind of blow the whole world up right now with the mm-hmm. climate strikes and everything. Mm-hmm. But the thing at Nexus that really did hit me was of all the, you know, there are three things you can do that are not striking or like, you know, talking about it all the time and making people annoyed. Three things you can do in your life that would actually make an impact. One, don't fly as much, right? Mm-hmm. You know, two, don't have a kid because the population is a big impact. And the third was eat plant-based diet. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? And really not even like go full plant-based, but like just decrease the amount. Yeah, exactly. Just decrease the amount that you eat.
Right.
And I just walked away from that like, well, I'm not flying as much anymore. I'm not going to have any more kids, I don't think. And so what can I actually do? And you know, I had already been on this health journey, you know. And so it was like, you know, that it seemed like it made sense. So, you know, I did some research for about 30 days and my wife and I talked about it and we were like, yeah, I mean, are we cool doing this? And so it's been
the wifey on too?
Yeah. She's much more in the like less than normal as opposed to like full on.
Right.
We have different personalities. I'm a very full on kind of,
I feel that.
You know what I mean? Yeah. Like if I'm doing it, I need to just do it.
Yeah.
But it has, you know, so the two things I've noticed, one is inflammation. So like in running, right?
Okay.
Like I'm 43 years old.
Okay.
For the last 10 years, I've always felt running in my knees and I'm not feeling it in my knees in like the last 2 weeks.
Wow.
You know what I'm saying? So there's definitely something, you know, you talk about the recovery piece. There's definitely something around the inflammatory agents in meat and dairy. I don't know what 100%. It is, but like,
that's exactly what
but,
it is.
But I'm not as inflamed as I was. So that's for sure true. But then also just like, just the peace of mind that comes from knowing, I know the realities of the food industrial complex and that it is a massive contributor to the climate change stuff. And, you know, if I'm opting out of it, that's at least a daily choice that I'm making that is not contributing to, you know, what could potentially be one of the biggest crises we have as humans that we've ever run into.
Adds to it?
Like, the carbon footprint of flying the carbon footprint of flying is really bad, man. Really? Yeah. It's a big one.
They don't have any eco-friendly jets. Like, that's a tough one.
I mean, but look, man, Greta's got to fly all over the world to go do these climate strikes. So you know what I'm saying?
True.
Yes. Again, the number one thing is really plant-based. Like in terms of all the things we could really do, like individually to make a change.
Yeah.
It's the number one thing we could do, and you could do it, and you don't have to like talk about it all the time. You know, like we're talking about on a show right now, but like I don't talk about
not
it. Yeah. It's not like a thing I'm talking about. But like, it is the one thing we could do that if each one of us did it, it would lower the carbon footprint just because, you know, the amount of It's just not good.
Like, you're saving so much, like, amounts of water and, like, you know, production of food, like slaughtering of animals, like, just from your diet, you're saving just so much.
Correct.
You know
correct.
What I mean? It's like a ripple effect.
Yeah.
But, like, the thing that we come to
contact, and once you know it, like, man, it feels so much better to, like, not be contributing to it. Like, once you know it. Once you know it and accept it as your truth. You know, other people, like, they come in contact with it, with information, and it's, you know, they don't necessarily accept it as truth, which is fine. Whatever. But, like, for me, when I look at this stuff and I look at what's going on, and it's October 1st, it's 99 degrees out, and, you know, I'm like, This seems like a problem to me.
You're talking about cognitive dissonance.
Yeah.
That's what you're talking about. Here are the facts. Here's my mindset and my thoughts. Nope. That's cognitive dissonance.
Yeah.
And like humans
are unique in our ability to deny reality.
Ooh, yeah. And I think it's unique. About self-awareness.
Yeah.
You know, and how you can look at certain patterns and like habits that you've been in like your whole life. Like we all go through programming for like the first 7 years of our life. And, you know, some of those stories we tell ourselves are true, some are false. And you kind of live your life based on those stories. And it's like you're on autopilot and you wake up and it's like, whoa, like I started meditating a lot and like my self-awareness on things started to increase. I'm like, wait, why do I do that?
Right.
Why do I think that way?
Right.
Is that because something my mother told me or my grandparents? And you start to like deconstruct things.
You're cutting these things off. Like that's actually not me. It's just a shirt I wore for 20 years.
Right.
But it's not like I can take that shirt off and I can put a different shirt on.
You can
totally. Yeah. It's no big deal.
Yeah, man. And I think that's something that we lack today in our society because there's so many distractions, right? It's like there's so many ways, things that distract you from actually having to deal with yourself and to really understand who you are and what you represent. And it's like, dude, like sometimes I even delete Instagram off my phone just for a couple of days. It's like,
opt out, man.
That felt good.
Right.
Like I'm not on the internet comparing myself to people and looking at other. So it's like, you know, it's one of those things where the more self-aware you are, the more easily it is to take in new information and properly apply it to your life.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? I think that's something that people need to be, you know, more aware of, you know.
So what's the future look like? You are recently retired. Congratulations on a great
appreciate
career.
It, appreciate it.
And thank you for serving it out here in Nashville
with
the Titans.
Feels like a sentence sometimes. serve my sentence.
I was thinking more like thank you for your service as opposed to like serving a bid.
Hey, see, that was my view on it.
Exactly. That was your own filter for that.
Yeah, I appreciate it, man. I'm glad. I thank God, man. It's a blessing to be able to stay in one spot for your whole career.
It's incredible, man.
Have some consistency. Lay down some roots. It's a blessing.
Yeah. So what's the future? I mean, I sort of know, but like,
yeah.
What's the future?
Yo, you know.
Well,
tell me. Nah,
I mean,
I know some of the things you're doing.
I'm
messing with you. I mean, I think you know, for me, a lot of what I'm doing now came from really awaking up on my financial side. And I think we may have talked about this before, but the private prison industry.
Yeah.
And, you know, I watched the documentary, The 13th.
Yeah.
And
that's a very hard documentary to watch.
Yeah.
It's a very hard documentary to watch.
That right there did it for me. And I watched that and I think this is right around the time where like Kaepernick, all the Kaepernick stuff was going on and the police brutality was just raging. And like, it was just, it's still like a divide in the country and, you know, Blue Lives Matter, Black Lives Matter, all these, you know, different divisive, you know, strategies and whatever you want to call them. And so I watched that documentary and I found out about, you know, the private prison industry, you know, GEO Group, Core Civic. I think Core Civic may be headquartered in Nashville.
It is. It is.
And so finding out that my money that's in the stock market could unknowingly be invested in these companies did not sit right with me. You know, I had to call my advisor after watching that and was like, hey, make sure I'm not in these companies. And, you know, I don't know what my money's doing. I don't know where it's spending the night. And that didn't sit right with me. And I'm like, I want to know what it's doing. I want to touch and feel it. And so from that, watching that, learning more, started to look at different ways in which I could pair what I was doing on the philanthropic side with what my money was doing in the private markets. and try to find a way to merge all these efforts and resources together.
So what you're basically saying is you didn't want to live a compartmentalized life.
100%.
Where over here, you're saying one thing, but over here, you're unknowingly doing something different.
100%.
Yeah.
100%. And I think...
life's better that way, isn't it?
Yeah, man. It's like, I want to do things that align with who I am and my values. And so, like, I think that you talk about outdated playbooks. I think we have a somewhat outdated playbook on philanthropy.
You know, totally. I'm so over it.
What's the guy's name? Was it Andrew Carnegie or James? What's his name?
Andrew Carnegie.
Andrew Carnegie, like steel pioneer from like the 20th century. And he wrote this thing called The Gospel of Giving.
Yeah.
And it outlined, and it was basically our playbook for the last 100 years on how to do philanthropy.
Pretty good that it lasted 100 years.
100 years.
Isn't it time
to do something more innovative? Like, what are we doing? And so I started looking at these things. I'm like, okay, I got this side over here, and I got this side, and how can we combine these efforts and, you know, be intentional about it? And I started to, like, discover the world of impact investment. Mm-hmm. And I was like, what's that? Like, is that another form of charity? Oh, no, it's not. It's actually investment. You actually make a return on your money. Like, you could actually align your investments with your values. And so I was like, oh.
And also incentivize sustainability.
Yes.
Like, which I think is the most important thing. How do you incentivize that these good things are sustainable and not every year coming back like, okay, we did all this great stuff. Give us another $1 million.
Right. It's like, you don't want so much dependence. It's like, you can set these, like you said, you can set these companies up and these initiatives up to be self-sustainable so they can go out and empower other people and empower themselves. And so I started to transition my money that was in my portfolio to impact investments. So to things that were like affordable housing or, you know, eco-friendly materials for construction and, you know, technology training for underserved entrepreneurs and all these things. And it was like, okay, I can sleep good at night. I feel better about what my money's doing and how it's working for me. But at the same time, I'm over here in this silo only making so much progress. And, you know, I've always, you know, been thinking about, like, always thought about how could, you know, people of influence and like-minded individuals who have somewhat of a notoriety or a platform leverage that, come together, create a group or a community of like-minded individuals, somewhat like a nexus, right?
Mm-hmm.
But like more like in, like, I would say, like, the athlete, entertainer space, influencer,
whatever. Leveraging that status, right? I mean, the status is there, and it's just going, you know, I mean, we saw the impact of the status when Colin put a lot on the line, right? You know what I'm saying? And that just kind of shows you, well, this is the power of status, right?
Yes.
You know what I mean? Like, if he was just if he was me, it wouldn't have made anyone near.
What's he over there kneeling for?
Right.
Like, what's he doing?
Exactly. Like, exactly. Know? Right. But it's because of who he was as an athlete. We hold athletes in very high status. And so, yes, I really wish someone would figure this out. This would be great because, you know, not all value is monetary. And when you talk about where is there diversity in power, or where do Black people in America have power? It's in sports and entertainment. That's 100%. Where it is.
100%.
And so how do we leverage that power, that status to do anything?
Have you read the book, $40 Million Slaves?
Mm-mm.
Man, it goes into that heavy, like, yeah, we're making so much money, but we're still on a plantation. And it was just
totally,
like, you know, dissecting that and like how we've been just kind of like fed and kept comfortable, and you kind of get disconnected from your community and you kind of like turn your back on it. And it's like, even like, I'm getting out the hood, like, I'm getting out the, like, yeah, get out the hood, but come back.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Right.
So
right.
It's one of those things where, how we had like this competitive nature about us in sports, and really to go even a level deeper, it's really in the Black community, where, what's the, that crabs in a bucket?
Crab in a barrel.
Crabs in a barrel metaphor.
Metaphor.
And it goes back to like that and like the Willie Lynch letter, how to divide the slave population based on complexion and hair type and like creating this hierarchy and separating people, right? Like,
well, it's playing into fundamental human, I mean, I would go a step further and I would say that dynamic absolutely exists in the Black community. It's a play on human psychology because we status is a big deal to us. Right. You know what I'm saying? Because status signals safety. You know what I'm saying? Like, we feel like if we're in a certain that's really where it comes from. It's like if I'm this is the house Negro field Negro thing. You know what I'm saying? But again, it's not isolated to the Black community. It's a wiring of humans where we see status as being something that is key to our survival.
Right.
You feel what I'm saying? And so because this was something that was done to poor white folks, there was no difference between poor white folks and Black folks in America, except if you tell the poor white folks they're somehow better, right? Really only giving them more status. Now they can say, oh, okay, well, at least I'm not that.
Right.
At least I'm not that.
That's
right?
Why they killed the brother from the Black Panthers. What was his name? He was like 23 years old.
What does that say?
Oh, I thought it was on 1 hour.
This is important.
Yeah.
This is really important. Yeah. Let's wrap on this. So,
what's the guy's name? They killed him. He was a part of the Black Panthers. 23 years old.
Because they killed it. Because they killed
from
several.
From Chicago.
That wasn't Huey, was it?
Not Huey.
You talking about Bobby Seale?
We gotta get this name. The reason I bring that up is because he was trying to
Fred
unite.
Hampton. Who? Fred Hampton.
Yes,
Fred Hampton.
Yeah. He was trying to unite Black people, white people, Spanish people, whoever, into like one united group.
Yeah,
and they killed him because that's dangerous.
Yeah, that's right.
It's
that's
like
right.
Divide
when,
and conquer.
When you try to show people that we're obviously so much more alike than we are unalike.
Exactly.
And by the way, this goes back to science, right? Like if you look at genetics. The difference between, if you look at the entire spectrum of humanity, the difference between the quote unquote whitest person and the quote unquote blackest person is like microscopic genetic difference from like us and every other species on the entire planet Earth. You feel what I'm saying? Yeah. So like this is all narrative.
Yeah.
This is all narrative.
Yeah.
All of it. Because at the end of the day, I'll tell you what, none of that narrative is going to help us overcome climate. Change.
True.
What? Are some of us going to survive it? Is some not going to survive it?
Exactly. It affects us all. It's a great point. And I think you kind of see it more, it's more exposed in our community because of like the cards we've been dealt.
Correct.
You know what I mean? And so it's like.
That's absolutely true.
To get us out of this position that we've been in for the last couple of hundred years, there needs to be a very intentional effort towards unity
and
understanding group economics and how to work together and build businesses and circulate our dollars in our community, all these things.
Yes,
right?
I agree.
So I'm transitioning. I say that to say this. What I'm doing now in the opportunity zone space, impact investment space, whatever you want to call it, is basically trying to do the things that I've been doing on my own, but at a larger scale.
Mm-hmm.
Trying to bring together some type of community of like-minded people who have a certain level of social cachet and influence to aggregate all these resources and really do impactful stuff at a great scale.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the mission that I'm on. That's the mission that me and my team is on. And that's the narrative that we're trying to push. And that's what we're trying to accomplish.
That's what's up.
Yeah.
That's what's up. Is it going well so far?
It's going well, man.
Good.
I mean, it's something that I wake up to every day looking forward to.
Yeah.
You know, it's something that gives me purpose, gives me a reason to wake up and go to work and have fun, man.
Well, no pressure, but we need you to be successful. So
no pressure, so, bro.
No,
I got you.
Yeah, no pressure, man. So so if this platform or anything that I can do can be helpful, let us know.
For sure.
But
same,
man,
here.
We're behind you and we're super proud of you, man.
Appreciate
super
that. Proud man. Of you. I appreciate super that, proud man. Of you. I thank you for having me on, and I think, you know, we keep this conversation going offline and really in the Nashville community is
absolutely
bringing this stuff together, man.
Absolutely.
For sure. All
right, man. Thank you for doing this.
Appreciate you having me on.
All right, man. Yeah.
All right.
Till next time. Peace.
Thank you for tuning in to Marcus Whitney's Audio Universe.